Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yetta. Each weekday, we strive to expose the destructive and the deadly myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, and with military, intelligence, and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission here is to understand what is actually occurring behind those headlines, all while predicting how the events they describe will shape our world over the next 10 to 20 years. Then, typically during our second hour, we engage God on His terms using evidence and reason. Although this is Friday and we expect to have IQ al-Rasuli to comment on a number of troubling developments in the world of Islam, in our second hour, we're going to begin with Yah's testimony. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion over the next 2 hours on either the things of Yahweh or the things of Islam, is 877-300-7645. Yesterday, as our program came to a close, we were talking about what you can learn when you observe the Shabbat, when you understand that the Shabbat is the special day. It's the day set apart. It is the day where God does the work necessary to facilitate the promises of the covenant. It is the day that we rely on Him to do so. And when we examine His instructions, His guidance, and His directions regarding the Shabbat, the seventh day, per His instructions, we learn that everything we need to know about His timing is provided by this instruction. And as we closed the program yesterday, I was talking about what happened in 3968 BCE, which is when Adam and Chawa chose a different course, given free will, given the opportunity to make that choice, and twisted and beguiled by the adversary, they chose poorly. And as a result, they were expelled from the conditions that we will once again find ourselves in the not-too-distant future. In about 20 years, we will return to the Garden of Eden. Now, in 3968 BCE, they were sent out. The Garden of Eden was shut down. It'll be reopened, and the whole earth will be turned into the status of the Garden of Eden here in just 20 years. But between then and now, we have experienced nearly 6,000 years of human history, and human history moving towards the fulfillment of all of God's promises, all on a schedule of 6 plus 1 equals 7. You see, if you go 1,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden, you reach the timing of the flood. We have the Burkle Impact Crater to affirm its timing and its location and its scale. One of these days, we will move into the presentation of the flood, and you will see that there is as much scientific and scriptural eyewitness accounts of what occurred and when it occurred as there were when we went through Yah's story of creation. 1,000 years from the flood, we had what was probably the second most important aspect of all of human history. Yahweh intervened, came to earth in the form of a man, and began a conversation with a man named Abram. And as a result of that conversation, the first thing that Yahweh asked Abram was to leave his country, to walk away from Babylon, to walk away even from his earthly family, so that Abram, who became Abraham, could become Yahweh's child. And that's precisely what occurred over the course of their lives. And what we find is that in 1968 BCE, we find Abraham on Mount Moriah, which means to revere Yah, doing a dress rehearsal for Passover, which would occur exactly 2,000 years thereafter. So 2,000 years exactly, which is 40 yobel, from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden to the time that Abraham and Yahweh were affirming the covenant, which is the means for us to return into Yahweh's home and to camp out with him in great joy, which is what Gan Eden means. We find the very covenant being affirmed on Mount Moriah as an affirmation of time, even in 40 yobel or 2,000 years from the time that the covenant relationship was severed with man. It has been reaffirmed. 1,000 years thereafter, we know that the cornerstone was laid for the house of Yahweh, the temple, on that exact same mountain, Mount Moriah. 1,000 years after that, year 4,000 Yah, in the fourth millennia of human history, the first four Moed Mikre were fulfilled. The reason that the first four were fulfilled is that all four of those are required to facilitate the five promises of the covenant. And so Yahusha in 33 CE, which is exactly 1,000 years from 1968 BCE, fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bakodim, and Shavuah, enabling us, God's covenant children, to become immortal, to live forever, to become perfected so that we are ransomed and saved, redeemed, becoming God's children. So that we can live with him and receive his guidance, his nurturing. And then on seven Sabbaths, the day that commemorates the celebration and the promise of seven, we are enriched with God's teaching, his Torah, and empowered by his Spirit. So the fourth millennia of human history, in year 4,000 Yah, the first four Moed Mikre were fulfilled, just as God predicted they would be in the fourth day of creation with the revelation of the greater light, who would be a sign for the Moed, these meetings. 2,000 years from 33 CE, 40 Yobel, takes us to year 2033. In 2013, that is just 20 years from now. And that is the schedule that God is on. That is his plan of 6 plus 1 equals 7. Year 6,000 Yah will occur in 2033 in our pagan calendars. Sometime between now and then, and probably in the range of 13 years from now, the Teruah harvest will be fulfilled. And those who have chosen to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant will be called home. The tribulation will begin. A 7-year period. And then Yahweh will return. It will not be the second coming of Jesus Christ. There was no Jesus Christ. And it will be his Yahweh's 7th visit to our planet in physical form. And that's going to occur in year 6,000 Yah. You see, a plan is developing, 2033. That happens to be also the last Yobel year within the lifetimes of those who witnessed the various signs that Yahusha gave during his Olivet Discourse, including the return of Yehudim to Yisrael and the rebudding and blossoming of the land, which happened as a direct result. So, my friends, if you pay attention to the Shabbat, if you observe the Shabbat as God instructed, if you pay attention to Yahweh's guidance and directions regarding the Shabbat, you know everything that happened that was important relative to our relationship with God and our salvation. You understand when it happened, where it happened, and when the last of his promises will be fulfilled and enabled. Relative to this, you know that he will return on Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliations, and that that will usher in years 6,000 to 7,000, or 1,000 years, the final time of the equation that God has established for us. 6, the number of man, plus 1, representing God who is one, equals God's idea of perfection, God's idea of the desired result. So, after 6,000 years, we spend 1,000 years together, camping out together on earth, returned to the conditions of the Garden of Eden. That is why it's called the Millennial Shabbat. That's God's plan. If we are observant, we can know. We can understand when these things are going to occur. Now, for those Christians that say, oh, well, you know, that our Lord Jesus Christ, he said that no one knows the day or the hour. Well, first, of course, there was no Jesus Christ. Second, he was quoting Zechariah at the time. Most of the what's called the Olivet Discourse, called the Olivet Discourse because they were hanging out on the Mount of Olives. Most of it is a citation of the end times prophecies as Yahweh presented them in Zechariah, which means to remember Yah. It's been corrupted to Zechariah. And the passage that he quoted where that no one knows is actually, it's the one day known to Yahweh, the essential day, is when he's going to return. And that's what the passage actually says. The Greek just reorders the words to make it sound like no one knows, as opposed to God knows the one essential day, the only day that's acceptable for his return, Yom Kippur in 2033. But even if you were to say, ah, well, I don't want to, don't tarnish my understanding of my precious Lord Jesus with that Hebrew stuff, with that Old Testament stuff, that's all been done away. Well, of course, it hasn't. There's no such thing as an Old Testament. There's no such thing as a New Testament. In fact, anything called a New Testament is completely bogus because the covenant has not yet been renewed. It will be renewed, but it's going to be renewed on Yom Kippur in 2033, October 2nd at sundown. And so, if you just want to look at the Greek, and you don't want to go beyond that, beyond the fact that, of course, that Yahusha didn't speak Greek at the time, the word that he's translated saying is related to no is Oida, and it was written in the present tense. So all he's saying, Oida, is the weakest form of knowing. It doesn't even mean knowing so much as it means cognizant of, aware, familiar with, just casually acknowledge. And so all he was saying is that you guys right here, I'm talking to you, you currently don't know. You're not aware. He didn't say that no one would know. He didn't say no one would figure this out. He didn't say that no one, that anyone outside that group was even aware. Just you guys aren't currently aware of when I'm going to return. But it's so easy to figure out. God didn't expect everyone to be ignorant. Welcome back to Shattering This. It is so obvious that Yahweh wants us to know who he is and what he has in store for us. He would not have provided us with such detailed instructions if he didn't want us to know. His constant guidance to us would not be, observe, you know, pay attention to my instructions, examine my instructions, consider my instructions, listen to my instruction. If he didn't want us to know, if he didn't expect us to understand, there would be absolutely no reason for him to say anything other than, just believe me, it doesn't matter who I am, it doesn't matter what I'm asking, you just believe me and everything will be cool, and you don't need to know what you don't need to know, because you don't really need to know anything if everything's going to be based on belief. And by the way, then, I'm wasting my time with this Torah, so let's dispense with that. I'm wasting my time with these 10 statements etched in stone, so let's dispense with that, because really, there's nothing for you to know, just believe. And in fact, if that Christian thing is right, you don't even have to know my name. You don't even have to know who I am. You can believe in a misnomer and everything's fine. In fact, you can even believe that I'm capable of giving you eternal life when man is capable of killing me. That's Christianity for you. So, you know, it's such a popular religion. Who am I as God to speak out against a religion that is the most popular in human history? You just go ahead and put your head in the sand. You don't need to know anything that I said. You can ignore it all. You can reject it all. You can even reject my name. You can change my name. You can say that man killed me and that that's the means to your salvation. What do I care? Well, why is all the evidence to the contrary to that? Why did God say that if you don't respect my name, Yahweh, that I'm going to separate myself from you and incarcerate you. It means you're going to hell. Why did God say that those who mislead others relative to respecting my name are covered in bull poo? What did he provide his Torah instructions? Why did he provide all of these predictions as to who he is and what he was going to do? Why did he come up with this schedule and stick to it? Why did he encourage us to observe his teachings, which are found in the Torah? Why did he encourage us to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant? Why did he constantly remind us that there are three aspects of his Torah that are essential for us to know? Which are the terms and conditions of the covenant, the prescriptions for living that cuts us into this relationship, and the means God uses to resolve our disputes so that we are reconciled, perfected, and can live with him, viewed as innocent. Now, all of the evidence points to and is consistent on the side of you want to have a relationship with God, you've got to come to know him. And if you want to know him, the only way you can do that is by being observant, closely examining and carefully considering the things he shared with us. And if you want to go from knowing him to actually having a relationship with him, he has laid out five terms and conditions of the covenant. You need to embrace them, accept them. Those terms of the covenant are, first, that we do what Abraham did. We walk away from our country, from patriotism, from politics, from militarism. From all things Babylon, Babylon in particular means to corrupt. And when God devoted his testimony to Babylon, he spoke of Babylon as being religious and how disgusted he was with religion. As a matter of fact, in that passage in Malachi that we were considering over these last few days, God specifically says that it is religion that looks like bull poo to him. Keep that in mind. And that's the first requirement of the covenant, that you walk away from religion and politics. God then says, instead of trusting and relying upon your government and your religion, come to trust and rely on him instead. Now, to do that, since trust and reliance isn't faith, in fact, it's the antithesis of faith, you actually have to come to know him. You have to know what he's offering. And then once you know who he is and you know what he's offering, once you understand those things, then you need to respond to them. You can't do that in a void of religion, of faith. The third thing God says, walk to me and become perfect. There's only one path to God. It begins with the doorway named Passover. It ends with God's home, which is Sukkah. It's a seven-step process through the Moed Mikre, all designated by the concept of seven. 6 + 1 equals God's idea of perfection, which is us being together. That then, of course, puts us in the position where God reinforced the single most important thing that we can do, which is to be observant. He says, observe my covenant. Closely examine and carefully consider my family-oriented relationship, my bereth. And when we do, these are the things we learned. And lastly, as parents, he asked us to circumcise our sons so that we and they would remember this relationship and would join him. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. One of the things that's just so appealing to me about God is that he's not capricious. Faith is irrelevant. He's not saying that, you know, I really don't care. I'm going to draw a line in the sand. You can come to me any way you want. And you know, who am I to be judgmental? And don't bother to learn anything about me. Don't bother to get to know me. I'm just going to save everybody. And I'm going to spend all of my eternity with people, regardless of how disgusting they may be. Yeah, that's kind of the Christian God. But the real God, the reason, one of the many reasons that he's so endearing is he's saying, you know, I respect you enough that I'm convinced that you can use your minds. I gave you eyes so that you can read. I gave you ears so that you can listen. You know, why don't you, and I gave you my Torah, which is my instructions, my roadmap, my guidance. I have every confidence that you are capable of reading what I have shared, come to understand it, and then respond to it. And for those of you that I'm right about, that you're capable of doing those things. I want to spend eternity with you. I created the whole universe to spend eternity with those who actually do what I'm confident that you can do. But just to use your eyes, use your ears, use your mind to come to know who I am, understand what I'm offering, choose to embrace it, and who wants to spend all eternity doing that very thing. Who want to spend eternity getting to know me better and me getting to know them better and spending all eternity in a voyage of discovery. Those are the kind of people I want to spend eternity with. And so God is saying, by the way, this is not an issue of you've got to be really smart to figure this out. I think we have done a satisfactory job on this program of showing that I am quite flawed. So this is not about being smart. It's about attitude. It's about prioritization. God's told us who he is and what he is offering in so many different ways, using so many wonderful metaphors and word pictures and stories and examples, that it's not about being smart. You know, oh yes, you got to be smarter than your local slug. But almost any human with a reasonable capability of thinking can do this. Even if you're blind, there's means to convey Yah's testimony. Like a program like this where we're talking. Even if you're deaf, you can read. If you're deaf and blind, well, that's probably a challenge. I don't know how that works, but not a whole lot of people that fall into that category. You know, my younger brother was mentally handicapped. But one of the things that strikes me about a lot of people that are mentally handicapped is just their attitude, especially towards relationships. So is God capable of grading on a curve, if you will, for those who have a specific handicap? I suppose. It doesn't say that he does. And my experience in studying his word is that those who are still children in terms of their mental and physical state, that the faith as to whether their soul continues after their life is really dependent upon their parents. Have their parents embraced the covenant? Have their parents attempted to raise them in the covenant? If the answer is yes, then from what I have read, then they are God's children. But all of this is just laid out for us to engage in a voyage of discovery, to expand our minds, to be able to observe and to respond to what we have come to know and understand. And that, to me, is exciting. So let's repeat Devarim 5:12 and then go on to see what else God has to tell us about the Shabbat. You should observe, which means to closely examine and carefully consider the Shabbat, the seventh day, the day of promise, which is set apart, Kodesh, separating, purifying. It is a special day. As Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, your God, your Elohim, instructed, guided, and directed. He then says, 6 days you can labor doing your ordinary work. And you can do all of your spiritual service, engage, if you will, in conveying Yah's testimony. But on the seventh day, observe the Shabbat. Observe the Shabbat. This is Shabbat, again, seven, promise, but written in a verbal form, as an active form. And so God is saying on the seventh day, Shabbat. So what is, you know, this is literally the same word, but written as a verb. You should seven. You should promise. You should Shabbat. And so when Shabbat is written as a verb, it is God telling us that this is an actionable event. You know, most people view the Shabbat as an inactionable event. You just sit on your behind and you don't do anything. You know, don't turn on a light switch. Don't push that elevator button. You know, don't get in your car and drive. You know, don't do anything. That's not about don't. Verbs are active. Here, Shabbat is a verb. And so there's an active way to engage in the Shabbat. So he says, on the seventh day, observe the Shabbat. Make the Shabbat actionable unto Yahweh for the purpose of approaching Yahweh. This is La Yahweh. La means to approach. It is a preposition that speaks of a goal, of being directed towards a goal, and of nearing that goal. So the purpose, he has said here, of observing the Shabbat, of the actionable aspect of seven and God's promise and God's formula, is to approach Yahweh, your God, your Elohim, your mighty one. On it you shall not do. Now here's a list. So he's told you what you ought to do, which is to observe his instruction, particularly as it relates to the concept of being set apart. So observe his instruction relative to his name and the concept of being set apart as it pertains to everything that's associated with seven, promise, and Shabbat. That was the first statement. And now he's saying that seventh day is actionable. That there are things that I want you to do, and he's listed what those things are. Pay attention to Yahweh's name. Pay attention to his instruction. Be especially observant, which means you're examining and considering. Note that this day is set apart, and come to appreciate all the things that the seventh day, Shabbat, means. In terms of God's promise, his formula of 6 plus 1 equals 7, and the fact that it is a day that God works on our behalf to nurture, raise, and support his children. So that's the actionable part. Now there's a part that is not actionable. He says, you should not, Asha, do not engage in, do not act upon, don't yourself do any of the spiritual service, the malacha, the work associated with declaring heaven's message from Malak, the spiritual messenger and the heavenly representative. What God says is that the purpose of this, of Shabbating, if you will, and shamarin, which is to observe, shamarin and Shabbating, is the recognition that God settles our debts so we can settle down with him. This is our dad's responsibility. He is offering his services to us, and what he's asking for us is to acknowledge that, to pay attention to that, to accept it, to embrace it. That's the active part of Shabbating, if we will. While the inactive part is recognizing we're not saving ourselves. There's a reason that Yahweh picked Dod, whom we call David, who was about as irritating as, in terms of not doing what the Torah instructed, is most any man, particularly if you're looking at the do's and don'ts of the Torah. But in terms of knowing how to observe the Torah from examining, considering, understanding, responding to the key aspects of it, which are the prescriptions for living, which are the means that God uses to resolve disputes and the terms and conditions of the covenant. He had that down. He was perfect at that, so God made him perfect. And so you've got a man who provides this example for us that tells us that if God can say that Dod, David, is vindicated, upright, righteous, and perfect, with all the things that Dod has done that are imperfect, then, excuse me, it is all about God doing this for us. And that's the message of the Shabbat. Don't try to replicate Yahusha's sacrifice. You know, when you read Paul's letters, Paul actually cast himself into the role of his own Messiah. He is the one making the sacrifice on behalf of all the little Christians in the world. It's gargantuanly egotistical, but Paul is the ultimate violator of this concept, in that he claims that it is his sacrifice that complete and fulfill the work that God could not do on his own. Nothing could be further from the truth. And that's what God is saying here. I don't want you to think that you can work for your salvation. So on the seventh day, on it, you should not do any of this, the spiritual service, the malacca. Malacca is a really interesting word. It's simply the feminine of malach. Malach is an extraordinarily important Hebrew word. Malach means messenger. And malach is used of the spiritual messenger, the heavenly envoys that represent Yahweh. It's particularly the spiritual messenger that provides the message of Yahweh. And who is the spiritual messenger who is most known to provide the message of Yahweh? Yahusha. And who aids and abets Yahusha's conveyance of that message? The set-apart spirit. And so their work, which is to cause us to be perfected, to cause us to become immortal, to cause us to be enriched and empowered, to cause us to be adopted children of the covenant, it's their work that we ought not do. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So God is telling us 6 days you can do your shtick. You can do your ordinary work. And you can do all of the spiritual service, the malacca. Malach is the feminine of malach. Malach means messenger. It is used in the presentation of Yahweh's spiritual messengers as they relate to individuals known incorrectly known as angels, but those envoys who do his bidding. The most important of those, of course, would be the two set-apart messengers, Yahusha and the set-apart spirit. So God is saying on the seventh day, just don't do those things. On it you shall not do any spiritual service, the malacca. Don't do the work that I've assigned to the set-apart spirit and to Yahusha, my heavenly envoys. Not your son, not your daughter, not your male or female servants, not your animals, or in today's parlance, means of production. And that those that I am speaking of as it relates to, well, your son, your and daughter is pretty straightforward, but in terms of those who work for you, your servants, and your means of production, it's those are within your gates. And it also lists, by the way, or foreigners. So if there's somebody within your community, your home, your property, you don't want to, if you have your own staff that maintains your something for you, give them the day off. You know, if you go to the local restaurant and somebody chooses to work, I don't see that as being your responsibility, not within your gates, not within your property. And if they want to work, that's their business. But if you have somebody that that helps you with your property, it is inappropriate to ask them to do that work on the Shabbat, on the seventh day. It's a day for us to rest and reflect, particularly our family, our sons and our daughters, on the seventh day, so that we come to understand what it is that God is doing with us. Resting and reflecting is the term that God uses. It's ruach, spiritually, resting and reflecting. Ruach is the very term that God uses to speak about the Ruach Kodesh. So the message that Yahweh, by way of his spiritual representative and heavenly messenger, he's saying that they have already accomplished everything which is required to ransom and to reconcile us into a relationship. So we're encouraged to rest and reflect on what he has done. The statement which follows is virtually identical to the one in Shemot, Exodus 20 text, which is the presentation, if you will, of what God wrote on the those two tablets. But in it, we find two additional reasons that the Shabbat is important. Previously, and actually on the stone tablet, Yahweh told us that it was the day that he rested and reflected after 6 days of creation. So if we follow his pattern, then we will understand his mindset. By following his pattern, we come to follow him. And that's a pretty good idea. We're also told that the day, that it was the day that he would bow down in adoration to greet and extol us, to lift us up. So the seventh day is the day that God actually diminishes himself, gets down on his knees in love to lift us up. So now, further tying the Shabbat to our salvation, he speaks of being mindful and of remembering so that we can reflect on all of this. And so you should be mindful, Zakar, you should remember that indeed you existed as a slave in the realm of the crucible of Egypt. And Yahweh, your God, led and brought you out from there with a strong and mighty hand and with the Almighty's outstretched Zeruah, or sacrificial lamb. So here we are considering Moshe's insights into the purpose of the Shabbat. When God wrote it in stone, he identified that this is the, he talked about how on the seventh day he got down in love to lift us up, and that we were following his pattern or his example. And now Moshe is saying, hey, there's another example here. The Shabbat is all about Yahweh removing us from being enslaved to human schemes, removing us from judgment, from the crucible of human oppression, and that he himself leads us by the hand, taking us out of these things.